Some people see it as empty space, others see it as a once-in-a-lifetime business opportunity. But really, it's a community and a way of life. A new documentary looks at the industrialization of rural America through the lens of the North Dakota oil boom. Between 2011 and 2016, oil drilling in rural North Dakota reached its peak, setting off a modern-day gold rush in the sparsely populated town of Trenton, North Dakota. My Country No More is produced and directed by Rita Begdadi and Jeremiah Hammerling. The film paints a portrait of a rural American community in crisis and questions the long-term human consequences of short-term approaches to land use. My Country No More premieres on Independent Lens Monday, that's tonight, at 9 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Mountain on SDPB-TV. And we have Rita Begdadi and Jeremiah Hammerling on the phone now from Los Angeles. Rita, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Jeremiah, thanks for being here as well.
Ditto. Thanks so much for having us indeed.
Jeremiah, let's start with you because it's an interesting story of how you sort of came in to these people's lives. Tell me how you ended up, how you and Rita sort of intersected with the folks of Trenton, North Dakota.
Yeah, so it's a long story and I'll try to give you the short one. I was originally born in Williston, which is just a slightly larger town next to Trenton. And my father was a pastor there in the 80s during the last oil boom and right around during the time of the farm crisis. And so we were close with a lot of the families there during kind of a tumultuous time around 30 years prior to this current boom. And so flash forward 30 years later, when this new boom had hit, we were getting phone calls from some of the families, specifically Callie Ryder, who ultimately becomes the protagonist of this documentary, saying that they were somewhat alarmed by these rapid transformations that were sort of once again sweeping the area, although now with technological advancements like fracking and low regulatory practices, quite more dramatic in a lot of ways. And I had moved out of North Dakota after graduating high school, had moved to Chicago for film school, which is where Rita and I met, and then ultimately ended up in California for work, and had long wanted to go back to North Dakota to try to work on a project, ideally a film, to kind of explore where I grew up. And it seemed like an ample opportunity to do just that.
There are so many themes at work here, and one of them is this notion of land and regret and land and responsibility. Rita, talk a little bit about, because these are people who are making decisions not only about what they're going to do, whether they're going to sell, for example, but what they're going to say about what's happening, how they're going to use their voices, if they should. It's incredibly complex. Let's start with this notion of selling land and making decisions that impact not only your family, but your whole community and generations to come.
Yeah, well, that's one of the themes that we wanted to focus on, or we learned that we had to focus on as we were shooting, is just this idea that we sort of have this short-term view of land use, and just even our time on this planet is sort of short-sighted in a way. And I think it's not to anyone's fault. It's just the way we're sort of, you know, rigged as humans is like, build up and do this in the moment because we have the opportunity. Everyone talks about opportunity, but few actually, you know, look ahead to the future and think, well, how is this going to change? And is that for the best of everybody? Is that for the best of the land? So it's actually a very, you know, it's a personal decision for a lot of these families, financially and, emotionally. You know, a lot of people are tied to it for a lot of reasons. And so making those decisions, you know, we saw was not easy for a lot of people, but, you know, it's sort of one that you kind of had to make in the moment because of the rapid pace that everything was going at. Yeah, if that answers your question.
Yeah. Jeremiah, I don't want to oversimplify everything that happens in the movie, but at its essence, there is a proposal for an oil refinery that needs to be built, and community members are coming in to weigh in on this decision. And then that proposal shifts and becomes, you know, possibly an industrial park, and there's more, which complicates things quite a bit more. And much of the rhetoric here is about, about business, about, hey, we're going to, quote, go back to the horse and buggy days if we don't get with the program and realize, what's happening in the world and the need for oil. This is American economy. And yet there's these farmers and ranchers, and there's just so much for them to process. But they're not newcomers to thinking about how land is used. This is something that they are deeply in tune with internally as well.
Right. I mean, I think you have a few things going on, and you rightly mentioned that it's pretty complicated because, you know, one of the things that we tried our best to tackle within the context of the film is that, you know, a lot of the agricultural workers, farmers, people that live off of the land, you know, they're very pro-industry, and they're very aware of the fact that a lot of how they, the means to go about their daily farm practices involve a lot of oil. And it's a pretty right-leaning place. It's fairly conservative in a lot of regards, you know, so even though people are very much aware of, you know, rotational crops, what they're going to do in their land if you're farming, or, you know, how, you know, where the floodplains are, how, you know, just very attuned to the weather patterns, this, that, and the other. It's the complicated relationship between agricultural and industry in rural areas especially is very much so intertwined. And I think one thing, you know, that became important to us was that there's also a sort of a distinction, I think, between, and this is true, I think, both in urban and rural areas, between, you know, people who own land or own property and people who don't. And there's this question of, well, do you have a say in how this area should be used if you don't own it? You know, and obviously this is becoming a big issue in urban areas where places are being rapidly gentrified. People are, you know, who are being pushed out aren't typically being listened to because they're not considered owners. And one of the things that, you know, we found kind of interesting with Callie Ryder's story and her family was they lost their farm in the 80s, but they still live in the area. And her father still did some farming and work in the area. And her brother ranched and still ranches, and she helps with that now. But, you know, one of the things that Callie realizes in the film is that just because we don't necessarily own land, we still live here. We still have a say in this area and what, how we think it should be utilized, preserved, and where we should put things. And so, you know, while at one hand, individuals who have lived a farming life for a long period of time, whether they own that land or not, have one particular relationship to an idea of how land can be used, there's a whole other side to it, which is like urban or rural planning in terms of how cities and communities should be structured, where things should be built. And that's a very complicated situation, kind of touching on what Rita was saying, especially when it happens in the context of something like an oil boom, where virtually overnight in a quote-unquote sleepy town, now all of a sudden you have hundreds of thousands of people flooding that area, and then trying to find, a million different ways to utilize that land.
Right. And Rita, let's talk a little bit about this idea of getting close to your subjects, because the camera takes us into all kinds of places in this community, including, you know, a Walmart parking lot where you meet an oil worker, inside a church where people are holding hands and praying, in the county commission meetings, meeting with people who have sold land and regretted it, meeting people who have sold land and don't regret it. So many different viewpoints. Tell me a little bit how you approach that as a filmmaker and are able to get some of the, you know, the conversations and the closeness that you accomplished in this film.
Absolutely. Well, I could say that that's kind of what Jeremiah and I, you know, that sort of built our careers on, is that intimacy and just sort of wanting that and striving for that every time we make a film. But also I think one of the ways that we do it is just through curiosity, is just simple, you know, actually wanting to know about these people's lives. And so when you walk up to someone, you know, we're not, we don't have an agenda. We're not, you know, trying to get, elicit a certain response out of somebody or, you know, get a certain angle. It's like, we just are genuinely curious about your experience. So that's kind of how we approached the Walmart parking lot. Although I was so freezing that I had to come in the car. So Jeremiah did a lot of that. But I had never, that was my first time to North Dakota, actually. And it was the coldest I've ever felt in my life. Right.
So, Jeremiah says, welcome. this is yeah, just January or whatever. Yeah. It's just Tuesday.
Another day in the Dakotas.
Right. But you have these people, Rita, you know, who you can tell. I mean, they might have their arms crossed. They're sort of, you know, their body language is sort of, you know, projecting a skepticism. Or defensiveness, but yet the words that are coming out of their mouths are genuine and connecting. Mm. And you can really just tell that, you know, from an audience perspective, there's a lot went into creating that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the last interviews we did was with, you know, Dwight Ani, who we had tried for years to get him to talk on camera because he's the one who was selling the land for the church. And that was, our whole story was revolving around this church. And he was very skeptical for years. And then finally he just said, okay, like, let's talk. And, you know, his interview ended up being just so open and honest and emotional. And, you know, we were shocked. And, you know, essentially we did nothing to elicit that. You know, it was just the fact that he was willing and ready. And I think some people just have to be ready. But, you know, across the board, though, this area, what I've learned, because I'm, you know, I'm an outsider. I'm from a small town, but in Maryland on the East Coast, what I learned is that this region is sort of, you know, people don't talk about their feelings so much, especially not in public. And there's this, you know, sense that they feel this deep, deep, deep connection to the land and to what they're doing, but they don't talk about it. So I think, you know, just having someone ask you about it is like maybe freeing.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I can talk about this, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah. And Jeremiah, so, go back, because Callie says in the, Callie Ryder, one of the people featured in this documentary, she says that the, you know, what happened in the 80s made a reticent people even more, you know, competitive with one another, you know, conversation. Mm-hmm. People closed down who used to be part of the community because of some of those, that legacy of the farm crisis, making, a people who are not necessarily prone to expression even more reserved.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. It's something that we talk about briefly in the film, you know, just in terms of how the farm crisis affected not only, you know, that area, but really the entire Midwest and much of the country. You know, just through that whole recession, a lot of people lost their farms. I forget the exact numbers, but it was in the thousands. It was thousands of farms that were lost. And it does have an effect. And I think there's, you know, you're already kind of living, I don't want to say an isolated life, but you're living a life that's, you know, in what a lot of people would consider an isolated life. I mean, I think one thing that I always appreciated about North Dakota and wanted to try to find a way to capture rather in a film was just this sense of, to me, it's not so much isolating as it is kind of a openness, and it's very hard to explain the feeling of like walking out your door and then, you know, your neighbor might be a mile away and that's your next door neighbor. But otherwise you can see from, you know, 5 miles, 10 miles down the way, because at least in the western part of North Dakota, before you hit the Badlands, you might have some rolling hills, but you can see a weather pattern rolling in. You can see the bus coming to pick up your kids, and you know you still have 20 minutes to get ready, you know, because it's just,
yeah,
it's more of a sense of freedom than it is a sense of isolation. But, you know, I think getting back to this idea of kind of not wanting to, you know, to be a little gun shy about expressing your emotions or about, you know, talking about some of the hardships that you've gone through. There was a comedian that, this is a little bit of an aside, but I think it'll tie in, that we like, called Dylan Moran. And he was from Scotland and, Great Britain. And he was talking about how, when he toured in America and Canada, specifically Northern United States and Canada, he didn't really understand why people were so nice. And then he was like, and then I got it. He was like, it's so cold that and so empty out there that if you weren't nice to your neighbors, you'd probably die. And there's some truth to that, because if you get into trouble, you need to rely on people. And so I think there's like, it speaks to sort of what I love about North Dakota and South Dakota and Minnesota and the regions that I know, but certainly it speaks to a larger area. Yeah. The niceness that you get, I don't think it's a false niceness. It's a genuine niceness, because people are just very, you know, it's a different way of life, but it's a good way of life. And I think that also speaks to why sometimes people are, you know, reticent about sharing some of their deeper feelings about what's tough, because it's, you have to be resilient.
Right. I'm curious to know what kind of conversations the two of you had during the process about, you know, sort of a homecoming for Jeremiah and a new experience for Rita, but yet trying to capture this way of life. And then the sunsets and the rainbows and the, you know, the dogs and the chickens and the oil and all the things that you sort of saw. Rita, tell me a little bit about what some of those moments between the two of you were like.
Oh, yeah. Well, we took like 12 trips out to North Dakota, and sometimes we stayed there for like 2 weeks. And, you know, we lived with our protagonists, you know, Callie's family and Roger's family. And, you know, we ate dinner at Ruben's house. And so, excuse me, we had a lot of time to sort of reflect, and we'd come back and, the conversations, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that we really sort of was puzzling and challenging is like, how do we show the space, and how do we show the space between people, and how is everyone connected, like physically, because the land is so vast. So we ended up buying a quadcopter, a drone for that. Yeah. But, you know, a lot of our conversations were around like the logistics and, you know, how cold is it going to be tomorrow, and how do we get to the meeting at 8 a.m. and not die on the road? Excuse me, that's iced over. But, you know, we also talked a lot about, yeah, themes and just, you know, what it all meant. And, you know, coming back to L.A., it's like in a totally different world.
Yeah.
So, you know, sitting in the editing room and trying to piece it all together, it's just, luckily we had Jeremiah's brother, Josh, who helped us a lot, and Jeremiah's father, and, you know, we had a lot of good help, so.
Yeah. When you launch a project like this into the world after all that up close, I mean, you're really sharing people's lives, and it's in progress. There's something, you know, Ruben Valdez, we talked a little bit about him as an oil worker and how much he has at stake, really, is trying to find work, stay on a certain path that's going to be a pathway that leads to, you know, some kind of meaningful life for him. What do you hope, Jeremiah, happens after, you know, people start really seeing the film? And, you know, you guys have won awards, and it's more than that. What do you hope the impact of a film like this could be, Jeremiah?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I mean, I think one of the things that we had talked about early, and this is nothing against these types of films because we love all of them, but we didn't want to set out to make a film like Gasland, I thought was a great film. If we were trying to learn about fracking at that time, of course it has an agenda, but you know, I think it was pretty spot on. But you know, for us, that was not important. We didn't want to, or rather it was important not to make a film like that, because we didn't want to come in and say, hey, here's our idea of what, you know, is right and wrong, and you know, then have a you know, kind of a campaign built around that, like what you would call a quote unquote an issue film. Those are great films to have because they're easy to tour college campuses and to hand out packets and to have questionnaires, and then people understand, okay, this is good, this is bad. And I'm not saying that it doesn't promote thinking, but our style is just a little bit different in that regard. It's a little bit more quiet. We'd rather just spend time with people and let them kind of do the talking themselves, and then the audiences can kind of make up their mind. Because, you know, I think most people would agree reality is not so black and white, even when, you know, 24-hour news cycle might have us believe that. And so we're just interested in more in kind of like seeing those gray spaces where you get to spend time with people on film and, you know, hear their thoughts, dreams, fears, and see where contradictions and complications lie. So in terms of how that translates into what we hope might be the impact, I would say for this film specifically, I think, you know, Callie and Ruben, in a way, although it's a different kind of trajectory for both of those characters, Ruben being the oil worker who comes out of state from Colorado to resettle in North Dakota to try to find a job on the oil rig, And he's homeless when we meet him. Eventually he gets a six-figure job and starts doing really well for himself and tries to integrate, kind of become part of the community. Callie, being somebody who grew up there, lived there, you know, third generation farm family. I think throughout the film, we're trying to show that, you know, both of these people and really anybody who happens to be, you know, living in whatever community has a say, should have a voice in how that community is developed, not developed, what's, you know, how that area changes. So I think, like, the best impact I think that we could get out of the film would just have people have discussions, have, you know, think a little bit more about, how can I participate, be a part of local politics, whether that's just going to a county commission meeting or, you know, if somebody's putting up a, whatever it might be, it doesn't have to be a industry related thing. It could be good, could be bad. It could be a new school in your neighborhood, just to know that you're actually, to encourage people to know that they're a part of their, an integral part of their community and that their voices need to be heard. Mm-hmm. That might sound like a simple thing, but I think in times where, you know, where our government's shut down and where not a lot of things are getting done and where people don't really agree on many things, oftentimes it's one of the few forums where we can actually come that's not on our phones, to look at each other face to face and find common ground. And I think we'll more often than not find that we do share things in that respect.